only technical difficulty, the lambda minus theta, especially that we are in this corner. So you can see this is theta. It will often be outside of the, except here, this will be inside, but for this guy, minus theta, it will be outside of the dominant chamber. You have to somehow reflect it back to the dominant chamber, but it can be done. And then you get some simple formula for this symmetric pattern. So now it's nice, it's symmetric, and the way how we got them is symmetrizing these equations, you can turn it back to show that these guys are in fact okay multiplied by the determinant is exactly a linear combination of these petals and things. And so now we can find the analog of,
well, it won't be precisely analog. If you remember in the B10 and other things, they had the ideal lined up like that, but for us, we somehow managed to find them on level k plus 1 always. So for them, it's 3, these were 2 ones where we have to do the defenses are ideal.
So for every level k plus 1, but basically for any, okay, these are the fundamental weights, which in this case is just 1, 0, and 1, 1.
And so these two with the corresponding patterns as
polynomials will generate four ideal. And that's now the honest ideal. Now it's symmetric. We are going to take a quotient of this theta form algebra. And that's going to be the theta form Fermi algebra. Okay, so that was, and then it works out. Now, and if so, you can go back to the multiplication table and you can find that it is precisely this. This is how we started, but the later formulas they gave for higher end, they all match up with this. So we were happy. So we found the multiplication. We have a, and then the, this is somehow, it's not in, we haven't found this in the literature. We found an important class of symmetric polynomials, which come from the equations. Anyway, so the quotient is the algorithm. And then one thing, because of this observation, we already know that the spectrum which we care about in the non-symmetric case will be contained in the spectrum of our algebra. And later we'll see that without these extra zeros, it will actually be the same. Okay, so I am going slower than I expected. So the really the difficult stuff, I mean, what we have done so far is nice and neat, and hopefully it will be at the end this part as well, but this was the hardest to prove, is to find the pairing. In fact, finding the pairing is not hard, because again, you look at NS2Ks and later NS3, they actually tell us, okay, we think that we found the right analog of S lambda, so we have this canonical basis in the algebra. The picture will be the same as before, that the quotient algebra will be having an editing basis, everything in this now is headline air chamber, so everything below level k, which in this case is the level 4, that level k plus 1 or up to level k. And so I have now the d lambda and these vertices. This is the basis of my algebra, editing basis. That's something which has to be here. And then so you can just define the pairing, and that's the pairing they give, basically. So the formalism uses something about the affine wild group action, affine SM action at level k. It's a modification of the previous polynomial precisely at the walls. So at the extra affine wall, you have some more thing going on, but it's, you can understand that. Anyway, so basically now the pairing will be not orthonormal with respect to this basis, only orthogonal. So there will be that's all this one minus t shows up. And so what we managed to prove is that just which is somehow the analog of those people's work, is that this is actually is a symmetric pairing. So this simple looking pairing is behaves beautifully with that multiplication. But remember the multiplication is done with respect to this more trivial idea. So it's a non-trivial thing to compute and to prove. So I am very quickly. So this is the hardest very sketchy to me. But the idea, what we do is to reduce everything to the formula of Gupta. Everything is almost the same heading as for Gupta, except when you are on the top floor, on the highest wall. And we found a way to get ourselves out of on that wall. So that's the argument for us like that. First, I tell you what the trace function should be. So this should be the trace function. And again, how did we know this should be the trace function? Well, we knew what the topological quantum field we should compute, and so on. So you knew that this should be the trace function, because that's the results come out from this. So you know what the trace function is. But then what you have to show is that this basis, which we have, is exactly what the quantum with respect to this pairing. So this is what we need to show. Once I can prove that this pairing coming from a trace is giving that result, then we are done. But this turns out to be a non-trivial computation. So first, for now, it's nice. It's simple. It's just a sum over the beta solutions of some Jacobian of these beta non-systematic beta Hausdorff equations. But it's, of course, it's nice, but it's also very implicit. So we rewrite it in terms of as used first. And then again, the problem is that, okay, you can ignite residues, but you will see that if either of them, or say both of them, are on this top wall, then you will get residues coming from infinity, not just from zero. So here, said that here's from the Jacobian, you have all the variables and one is 2 up to z minus 1. So besides the usual beta poles, you also have just the usual coordinate pipettes as well as for the zeros to study. And so the problem is if you are on the top wall, then you have residues at infinity, and that is something we need to compute either. Or what we did, we rotate ourselves off from the wall. So there is this extra symmetry in the estimate case which rotates this simplex. It's a cyclic group of n elements. In this case, Z3, and what we managed to prove that this pairing is independent by these rotations. The rotation is independent like that. And then we compute that the rotation gives the same residue formula. And then with the rotation at least once or twice, you can make sure that I think it's enough that one of the guys get off from the top wall. In that case, you can show that there is no residue at infinity. And then you can come down to the residue at zero. And then, if you notice now, this looks like much more like the Gupta thing. The denominators will no longer evolve because these things are basically zero just the smallest possible order. And so, basically, you can apply Gupta's theorem, and that will imply the result. Because we are now off from the top four. And then finally, you can actually make nice applications of what we proved, and you can get you have as many dimensions for the algebra precisely as the number of these guys in this chapter. So that was finishing the computation, and I wanted to finish with showing you why you might want to care. So again, what I am trying to emphasize is that this other people's work already give the formula for the Fehling formula, or even these kind of pairings and stuff. But it's always in terms of solutions of the beta Hausdorff equation, which is highly implicit. So of course you cannot solve them explicitly. In the case of the non-TD quantities, the solutions were just roots of unit, so in that case it was less implicit. But even that was hard to understand. And so I want to show you why you might want to really compute the result and don't leave it in this implicit form. Oh, yeah, here comes first the computation. Okay, so now I'm just telling you, you should believe me, that once you know the Frobenius algebra, then you can plug up the trace function, and once you know the trace function, you can compute the partition function, and it is the partition function. You can compute it. And this is where the other people would stop here. might have even residue from the old labels here, but this residue from the steel and these implicit assumptions of the petalazids. And we like to have a global residue theorem turned out to be non-trivial in this case. The poles are not that neat at these other poles, but that's somehow our philosophy, is that if you turn over a global residue theorem, then you would have zero, so what we call the Scott-Arnheimer rearrangement, and that's the one which should show the original form of the computation like that. Okay, so this gives us back our form in the X2 case. In that case, I can tell you this is the Jacobian to the power of G. Somewhere here is this guy. It is the beta results, the theta 1 beta results, and it is psi t times psi 1. This is the usual Bell, the Bell measure, and this is the theta 4 version. And so, and then you rewrite now, I think, on the zero. So this is the zero. Okay, and then everything mentions what they do, and in fact, the general formula is precisely this. But let me now finish with this geometrical thing, which I have promised. The geometric information encoding is T characters. So I just told you so far it's some abstract form of power series, but let me convince you that this form of power series really understands a lot about the geometry of the X-Majorie space, and in particular of the Hitching system. So I couldn't talk about the Hitching map so far, which is, I admit, a big omission. So I just sort of do it very fast. So I'm sure you have seen it here already. The Hitching map is really just taking the characteristic polynomial of the Higgs field. In the case of SLM, like now, we have the trace of the Higgs field is zero. So we don't have that coefficient, but we have all higher coefficients. That's why this sum goes from 1 to n, not from 1 to n. So, for example, okay, the talk is about SNN, but for GL1, if you do it, it's actually very simple. In that case, the GL1 X-Majorie space is just the cotangent bundle of the Jacobian. And so, in that case, the Hitching map is just the projection to the second factor. But it's a nice, simple example because you see that the fibers in this case are always the same, but it's an abelian or an isomorphic with an abelian variety. And that's the general picture, amazingly. For any group, it turns out that the Hitching map is a completely integrable system, and in particular, one property which is important is that the generic fiber of the Hitching map is isomorphic with an abelian variety. In the case of SRN, this abelian variety can be understood as certain prim variety of the spectral cover at the point of the Hitching base A. So it's a nice abelian variety. Okay, so now let's go back to our problem. We want to compute the secvariant index of this Lyman on the total space of the Higgs module space. Let's think about the Hitching map. Why don't we first push this bundle L to the K down to the Hitching base using the proper Hitching map, which I haven't said, but it's another important property of the Hitching map, is that it is proper. So we can nicely push it forward. And then one property, not to the property of the Hitching map, it is flat, which means exactly that this cohomology spaces will not jump along the fiber. So what we are going to get is going to be a T equivariant vector bundle. So amazingly, this T equivariant vector bundle knows about our problem, right? Because if I now take the equivariant index of this over A, I get back the formula I want. But this is a T equivariant vector bundle on a vector space, really. I mean, this is really a vector space, the base of the Hitching map. And there aren't many vector bundles on a vector space. It turns out that there is only the trivial one, which is also true invariantly for an abelian group, in this case for C star. So we know that the equivariant vector bundle on the Hitching base is, in fact, just comes from the zero fiber. The zero fiber, which is the nilpotent cone or the core of the Higgs module space, is some similar but proper subvariety, and it's the cohomology there, V0, is going to the C star action. So it's going to be a finite dimensional vector space now in the C star action, and the total vector bundle you just get by tensoring this with the trivial And so with this picture, okay, so this is a non-trivial result, which is the Euclidean version of the Serre conjecture, that it always has to be trivial, coming from just a vector, a finite dimensional vector space. And if you now accept this, then you see that first we have this Euclidean character of this finite dimensional representative vector space V0, which is going to be the Euclidean index on the nilpotent cone itself, which is a projective variety. The space of section is finite dimensional. The C-star action will break it into finite dimensional positive and non-negative dimensional spaces. And so that's why we can write n here. So we have a polynomial now with non-negative coefficients. And we have one more information. This is the constant term of this polynomial. It precisely corresponds to the sections which don't rotate, and we are always coming from the moduli space of stable bundles where the x will be zero, and that's the usual pair here. And this part we can also see. Oh, the other thing we know about this polynomial is we know that the rank of the generic fiber, right? The generic fiber will just be the space of sections of alignment on an abelian variety, some sort of theta functions. So we know that in the rank of that, some very simple rank. So we know the rank of the vector bundle. And this way, we know that the result will look like this. We will have the Euclidean character of the Hitchin base there. So this, the result will always be a rational function like that. The denominator will just be the Hitchin base. Coming from the Hitchin base, you have the weights on the Hitchin base going from 2 to n. Here is the multiplicity of the weight, which we know just by computing the dimensions here. And the numerator contains the nilpotent cone, where we know, okay, I'm not spelling it out, but we know that it's a positive polynomial. The constant term is the usual Fermi number, and t equals 1, the total dimension gives us the theta functions. So for example, I just want to give you so we compute this really, not just these abstract terms, you get a rational function like that. And you look at it, and you see a lot about the Hitchin. If you see the Hitchin base, how the C-star acts on the Hitchin base, this is the dimension of the Hitchin base. This is the weight of the, and for SL2, there is only one weight. The numerator is in the equilibrium in the formula for the important cone. Here is the Fermi number. And then t equals 1, you get a 2 power 2, 156, which is the dimension of the theta functions in the generic fiber of the Hitchin mass. So it's, I find this beautiful that in a simple formula, I can learn a lot about the geometry of this geometry space. So in the remaining 2 minutes, I can finish by listing some problems, and that will conclude the talk. So Dan was asking about the general story, and indeed, most of our computations can be the constructions can be done for any other group, but we cannot prove the orthogonality necessarily because we don't have this rotational symmetry we use to play back everything to the Gupta base. It's not available for other groups. But these are the guys, of course, they work for the more general groups, and basically the geometry there should also require these kind of results, but they won't have our combinatorial understanding. Okay. Then you have parabolic X bundles. You know what states, right? If it's a punctured Riemann surface, you know what to twist at the punctures with. And so we understand what to do with the parabolic case, or the physicist tell us, or and very nicely now a student of an ex student of Andy Laura and with others prepare this and other physicists, I don't know. They managed to do the first computations for ramifications of irregular type, very particular ones, when you have a C-star action. And that relates to even more future or more complicated physics. Then you can ask about the combinatorics here, why I really like this, because it starts to remind us the combinatorics in the other story. There we had, as for the Hollywood polynomial shown, but eventually the McDonald polynomials show up, and you can easily imagine that this story deforms the McDonald polynomials as well, and we are very curious to try to understand that possibility, and what would be the geometrical quantity of the X-moving space that might compute. That's really the excitement, because the hope is that at the end we can connect the two topological quantities, there is on that side and one here. And an immediate hope is to compute equivariantly the Hirzebruch-Y genera of X-moduli spaces by these equivariant localization techniques. Then the hope is there will be a similar TQFT behind it. And then really, then if you could understand that, maybe we can somehow find a common deformation of this theory model in the first part of this lecture course. Then you can ask, of course, always the most interesting possibility, just like in the case of the SUN Chern-Simons theory, the real interest came that actually these theories extend to three-dimensional theories, and that gave us the Jones-Witten polynomials and all that not invariant, so it's very exciting. It's not obvious at all that these theories will have an extension, but maybe you have to modify them somehow to get an extension to three dimensions, so that's an interesting possibility. Then there is the representation theory aspect in the non Fidapon case, the usual term in the case, this combinatorics is known to be related to the representation via quantum loops, affine algebras, and Hecke algebras, a group of unities. And so the question is, do we have natural D deformations of those theories? And finally, one of my favorite possibilities, which has to do with this geometrical picture, I think we can be relate this to the Evianization. Okay, I don't have it.
Questions? One question. In the McDonald polynomial, the second variable doesn't have to do with the x plus q, with x plus k, I mean? With the McDonald, you have a t. If the q is not related to the exponential of k,
one way to do that would be to think about the other variable, which would be q, and the other variable t would be k, q to the k. That's one way to think about it. Yes.
So in some sense, you already have the two variables in there.
Yeah. So yes. So there are version deformations of the Fermi algebra where this point of view is taken is of the magnitude picture. Another question. I have many questions. The other question is, it's not going to be the same as the Avalanche-Shapiro thing, but this problem, again, indicates the possibility. If you can do this deformation, the hope is that you can include theirs as well. Yes. But for me, that's the most interesting question. What is the geometry behind such a potential? The possibility is a divisor, it won't give us or there will be elliptic origins, that's another even further extension, fortunately. But the physicists are saying that, we should be looking at the sigma model, so it should be more like a quantum homology or K-theory, what we should be looking at. But that's a computational difficulty that it's a loop origin or the elliptic genus can be just localized to the fixed point sets, no additional extra technical difficulty, but in the quantum K-theory,
so when you say can you enhance your 2D TQFT with 3D TQFT, do you mean realizing it as a dimensional reduction of the hyperdimensional?
Yes, so is there a three-dimensional topological quantum field? So yes, so that I get mine by multiplying yourself.
Okay, so the same way that the ordinary Boolean algebra comes out.
Exactly. Okay, yes. Well, that's the motivation. But as I say, there is some issue about integrality. The result here is not an integer. It's some polynomial or rational function T. But maybe some formalism that.
Is there an integrality to the coefficients?
Yeah, I showed you, right?
Yeah,
it's a rational function in positive integers in the coefficients. Right. So there is some rigidity.
on that theme, if you look at the Berlinda algebra, you can describe the vector space of this, it's just space of sections of this Lyman-Lyman genus 1. The space of conformal blocks is the space of section of your lambda 1 modulus based upon this in genus 1. That vector space, at least, has an obvious speed application, where you can look at the cotangent bundle of the space of G1 is in genus 1 and look at
usual numbers. Yeah, but what's the algebra structure? There is not even a vector space, you can see.
Right, but that algebra structure comes from the topological group. That you can see.
Yeah, so as vector space, I think I can see the same thing.
Okay.
But
okay.
I think the trick is the algebra structure. And really, I think that it comes from the three-dimensional part.
I don't need to know about it.
That the k equals 1 things behave the same way as the algebra 1, the algebra. But when k equals 1, the algebra is very simple. I mean, I should mind you to show that it's isomorphic. Right, it's basically just the center, it's just the group algebra of Cn. When k equals 1, then I only have these values. These guys correspond to this rotation, so it's just the group algebra of that, and this is the same for the Fermi algebra. That's the only question. So I think multiplication is going to be the same because it's going to be the group algebra on that center.
But you could use Fermi.
Oh, sorry, I'm confusing myself. Yeah, you want genus 1. I also want k equals 1. You are right. But genus 1, in simplifying, as well.
Yeah. Other questions? All right, let's thank Tomasz again for a wonderful lecture series.
That the traces of the endomorphisms of the vector spaces at the vertices have to add to zero. Very significant of the algebra of the sum of these algebras. Okay, so now comes this idea that this is really the automorphism group. So this group, of course, acts on the space of representations from the left and from the right. So basically, this is the representation we would like to understand, right? The orbits of these are the representations of the isomorphism. So that's the cool setup to have. And then we want to do geometry, so we will do this doubling procedure, and we will now take, we want to take a quotient, and the quotient then has to be at some level in the invariant part of the algebra. And now we can form what is called the Hilbert variety. So Hilbert variety is just such a symplectic quotient attached to a representation space on the computer at some level, sorry. Okay, so that's an honest definition. It's going to be an affine variety by construction. It will have at its smooth points anyway a symplectic form. So it's a nice symplectic variety. Now comes this issue about being indivisible. And it turns out that precisely when the dimension vector is indivisible, then in this case the center is going to be simple. I mean, it's just going to be the center of each of these GLs, each of these GLs and the vertices. So if you have an invisible one, it turns out that you can always choose a psi in there, which is therefore now, if you have at least more than one vertex, this will be now a non-trivial space. And then it turns out that if it's an invisible dimension vector, you can always choose a generic enough psi so that the quotient is going to be non-similar. So both the level psi the action of group the loop will be free on that. So then you will get a nice motion, smooth space. And that's the reason why the Crowley board quantum value approach works in this case, because this one can be made smooth. Because if it is divisible, then because of that thing, in some simple linear algebra, you can see that no matter what sign you choose, provided that it is not like the quotient is going to be non empty or the other set is going to be non empty, it will always have a scaling point. So you can never make it smooth in that case. Okay, so then the non empty, the variety is non empty, then it has a computable dimension into some, again, I'm not going to define this pairing on the dimension vectors, but some nice pairing, depending on the curve, you can compute the dimension, which is easy, of course, to compute because you know what the expected dimension should be. So the dimension of this vector space is going to be minus two times the dimension of the group, so it's easy to compute, that's what you get. Okay, then I'll now sketch you the proof of the second conjecture of Katz, which in the case of Crowley and Bowie was somehow easier. So in that case, when alpha is invisible, the way how Crowley Bowie wanted to prove Katz's second conjecture was by some nice geometrical argument, really, showed that this smooth Krüger variety, a priori depends on psi, but it turns out that the number of points over a cube will not depend on psi, so the number of points on the Krüger variety turns out to be basically this Katz polynomial of the Krüger with that dimension vector. So you remember that you have like the cross of R was the Krüger and the dimension vector. So in particular, we know because Katz proved for us that it was a this is a positive non-negative number, so that this is a polynomial in Q. So this should be there for the E polynomial. And if you additionally can prove that the variety you have is has a pure homology, then you know that this will have positive conditions because it's basically just a concavely supporting quaternary polynomial. And then M alpha is Fi, so it has no chance of being semi-projective. You remember in semi-projective variety, we had this east direction, whose fixed point set was assumed to be proper. The Fi varieties won't have a trivial proper subsets. I mean, it could be an isolated fixed points, maybe, but typically these are not on the face of them semi-projective. But from our perspective, we could have taken the quotient at zero level, but took a non-trivial GIT quotient, and those things will be semi-projective. So you would know those have pure homology, and you can put them into family with these guys, and then you can show that the homology doesn't change in that family. That would be your perspective. Back then, I think it was Nakajima who wrote an appendix to that paper, which proved this crucial thing. Okay. And then when you have this, then you see that the E polynomial is really just a Poincaré polynomial, and then you have a beautiful geometry meaning for the Katz polynomial, that it is just a compactly supported Poincaré polynomial of this Fi simple variety. And therefore, it has no negative coefficients. So that was, I think, a very nice geometrical proof that you took. And then the divisible case was hard there because there was no obvious variety, smooth variety to attach. And the variety is not smooth, so these arguments about purity came down. And also the geometrical relationship between pure representations and absolutely pure representations that breaks up as well. So basically, the basic techniques don't work in the case of alpha is divisible because the pure variety is singular. You cannot choose some generic enough. So in this case, what I'm just going to sketch this one, and I will spend more time on the first conjecture, because this part may be more technical, although conceptually may be easier to say how or proof. And what we did was that we invented a bigger Krüger, we embedded somehow. So you have your Krüger, some abstract graph, parentheses. And what we did, we just added a long leg to every vertex. So we have some theory inside. And then we studied the equivalent variety attached to this bigger one, and we put in dimension vectors. So if you have a dimension vector n, then it would be m minus or n minus, the full leg. We put the full leg at that vertex, and we managed to think about this bigger equivalent variety, because now these ones, the n is always a 1, it's always a divisible. Indivisible dimension vector, so the total space of each thing is going to be smooth. So what we did, we constructed this cube, which is roughly this everything. We have many vertices and we added a lot of long legs. Then we had constructed this dimension vector, which is set in birds. So if you had a dimension and here, you just count it down by one, you hit the full leg, that's the alpha prime. And finally, the non-trivial thing to show was that the Y groups, so you have a Y symmetry reflection at every vertex of the Hur, it acts on the cohomology of your Hur variety. It's a non-trivial nice construction going back to Nakajima. But if you just only took at the extra vertices you add in, you take that part of the Y group, then it is just going to be a product of some symmetric groups. It's a nice group. And it is going to act on the cohomology of this big thing. And what we were lucky to find is that you know, you have these big products of symmetry groups acting on the cohomology of your Hur variety. You decompose it into the irreducible representations of your group. And in this case, there is a unique non-trivial representation, a sign representation for each symmetry group. Take the sign representation, take the tensor product of that, and you get this one-dimensional representation of that group, not trivial, the sign representation. And it turns out, this is what we managed to prove, that the component of the cohomology, which is the isotypical component corresponding to the sign representation, gives precisely the Katz polynomial of the original Hur. But this, you really used a lot of geometrical ideas about these Y reflections and stuff, but as saw the computation, it showed this is less conceptual than in the case of there. So they actually really had a map from this set to this set and the fibers at that side. We don't have that in India. I mean, because it's not on a set, right? This is just on the cohomology. So it's harder to relate the two. What we did instead just computing it. Anyway, that was nice because this is a bit more complicated, but again, this is some kind of gradient vector space. Some kind of vector space, and so its dimensions are always negative, so that proves the conjecture. I mean, that was just about the easier to explain part of the second conjecture. I also wanted to say a few more words on the first conjecture, but also in the second conjecture, when we computed this thing, we used the same computational technique, this Fourier transform idea, which first I arrived at trying to do the same thing as Frobenius thing in the multiplicative case, but then also we paired up with Amanda Letellier who wrote this thesis about this kind of Fourier transform. So this was natural to do. So now let me explain this. So this implies. Completes that conjecture too. Okay, and I'm going to tell you in a moment this Fourier transform idea, but I have to introduce another set of, again, the isotopic Hur varieties. I know as of the previous ones were studied by Nakajima, but somehow these are the more famous or Hur varieties Nakajima studied, so I put these on the Hur varieties. They come from not a single dimension vector as here, but another one as well. So now every vertex, this will be my example, the Jordan Hur, but now I will have two dimension vectors attached to a vertex, say, and
Tabby vertex now you have two vector spaces. One is the usual kind, the E, which was similar to the one before. And then there will be this extra vector space, which you should think of as this frame vector space. These are not frame the representations of the original pyramid to V's, but we will have some also maps from W to the V's, but only at the vertex. So the group is the same as before. It's only the going to be the not quite the same, right? Because we now no longer need to, or there's no reason to divide by the central subgroup. So we just take the whole of the automorphism of those vector spaces. That's the same group. And now, instead of just the usual representations of the universe, that's the usual representation for the SR displaying because it's now the vertex, I will have a homomorphism from this ring vector space to the
inner VI. You assume that the little WIs are positive.
And then it will be that if all the W's are zero, then it's the same thing as before.
But you don't divide it by the same.
In that case, you should also be high.
If there is one W which is not zero, then there will be no element which will act together, right? Because the point is that
yes,
the scalars are here, but here they only act from the it's enough to have one non zero.
And indeed, the Nakajima thing would be empty. You will see in this construction, they'll actually always take a quotient which is trivial in the case of the topics are zero. Yeah. Okay, so now we'll be to. I call this holomorphic symplectic quotient because this idea comes from differential geometry. The usual symplectic geometry, instead, we do this complex holomorphic way, but actually, we do everything algebraically, so probably better. Okay, so now I take the moment map construction by doubling this vector space with the action of G on it. And now I always take a particular element, the identity element, at every vertex. And it turns out that this is always going to be a regular value of the moment map. The group G is going to act freely on it. So here is somehow it's easier to see. There's no choice of sign now. It's an affine quotient, it's an affine Nakajima field, right? It's always the smooth symplectic, edge-based symplectic, right? The engine is here saying some computation about the dimensions of this minus twice the dimension of this G. Okay, an example, like example. So it's the Jordan pillar, two vector spaces, one of dimension n and the other one is dimension m. And then these are what are called the affine AB adjacent spaces. This is an interesting example because this was the first Hilbert variety studied. This was before Nakajima, so it would be not called Hilbert varieties. But to get the honest AB adjacent space, again, you have to take the quotient at the zero level, and now you have to have a non-trivial polarization and take a non-trivial GID quotient, and again, the polarization in Nakajima's work is a fixed one, which somehow corresponds to this identity that we are. And that's a semi-projective variety, and that's the famous A-Digit space, what A-D, what here, Quinta, Digit, and Money, constructed as the moment space of SU, M instantons on R4 always. There is some behavior which is okay. And the case when m equals 1, then you would note that this is like what you would do for the Hilbert scheme, but again, the Hilbert scheme is semi-projective, so it cannot be affine. It's not affine. So it's the sum of the affine deformation of the Hilbert scheme of endpoints on C2. This is called sometimes the Kolobchev Moser system, because it has some nice integrable system. Anyway, these are two nice famous examples of Nakajima variants. Although the pure it has to has a loop and some of the things we want we cannot have loops, so it's maybe not the best. Okay, now quickly I sketch you the idea of trying to do the same kind of Frobenius formula pounds we paid for content IDs for these synthetic oceans. So we want to do a fully adjusted one, which will give us the kind of proteins formula we were so successful in the content ID case. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you this fully adjusted one. So we start, the other thing is going to be on a finite field of Q. And the nice thing will be is that compared to the usual Fourier transform, everything is finite, there will be no convergence issues. So we just take the same formulas as the usual Fourier transform people do, but we don't have to care about convergence. What we have to care about, which is less obvious, what is the analog of the exponential function, which of course goes into the definition of Fourier transform. The role of this function is going to be played by this additive character, so you take FQ as its additive structure, and then you find a homomorphism of this additive in the bigger group into C star, and then you find a non-trivial such character, and you fix it. So there are more than one, but we just choose one of them. So you fix that, and then our Fourier transform is going to depend on that choice, or the choice of the exponent. Of course, the exponential function also has the same property. This is a non-trivial additive character of the additive group of, say, the complex numbers to C star. Okay, so now what we are going to construct is the Fourier transform of a function on the finite set of points, the finite dimensional vector space over FQ to C. So it's a finite dimensional vector space of all such functions. I take one. And then we just define the Fourier transform by this simple formula, which again, if instead of the sum sign, you replace it with an integral, then it should be familiar here with exponential. This is the usual formula for Fourier transform. Okay, so then to any function, you can construct this Fourier transform, and it has various nice properties, basically two main properties. We only use one now, is that if I do it twice, I take the Fourier transform, then I basically get back my original function up to some minor deformations, like an extra scalar comes up here, or which you could actually put in the Fourier transform definition, but this is one way to do that. Anyway, so that's going to be useful. Therefore, if you know the Fourier transform of your function, then you can know your function just by taking. Okay, so that's great. Now, we are going to use this Fourier transform on this linear symplectic quotient set up over a finite field. So now we have this V, which is, you think of this being living over a finite field. I take my group now, we think of this as being over a finite field, so I'm deducting over FQ. But formally, over FQ or FQ bar, you can do the same kind of algebraic geometry. We will have the action with the homomorphism. I can take the derivative, and this is just now the algebra homomorphism, etc. And then we have this formula, an explicit formula for the moment that I showed you before. Okay, so now we are going to do this over a finite field. What we will be interested in, we will want to know the number of points of the level set of this moment map. Which comes for any element here, not just the central ones, not just the invariant ones, where we really are interested in. It turns out you have to look at all of them, and then you see that it will have a very nice Fourier transform, that function. So now, not just for central ones, but any element in my the dual of the algebra, I will count the number of solutions of this moment map equation equaling that one, so the number of points. So this is my count function, which is this one. Count all the points where the moment map takes the value of sine. Okay, and then the way to compute in this is to rewrite everything in terms of pure delta function silly way, but because again everything is finite, I can do this. And the nice thing is that you can compute easily with the Fourier transform of these delta functions. And basically doing that you get the it's actually a very simple observation. There is nothing to it. It's just a simple computation to compute. compute the Fourier transform with the count function is some very simple function. It's actually a function whose value is always just some q power and the number of points in the finite field, which is just some q to the dimension of the vector space, plus another q power, which is the number of points in a subspace of the algebra. So the map is here, so the matrix is for every x, I have an element here, so an endomorphism I can take the kernel of that. So it's a subspace of V. And again, that's the statement. And as I say, it's a very simple computation. The only thing we use is just this formula for the moment map. And the nice thing now is so you computed the Fourier transform something, you find something nice, and it is really nice. And then to get back your count function, just compute the Fourier transform again. So this way, you get that the count function is a simple function, is the Fourier transform of this AO function, and the AO function is precisely this function, which computes, which is always a q power, computes the kernel of these matrices. For every x here, take the corresponding matrix and compute its kernel. It's a very simple function, this AO. Okay, I mean, okay, it's easy, but then the very nice thing about such a computation is that you can effectively do this for non-homogeneous varieties. It's not, that part is not that straightforward, so in the computation, you reduce things to, so the computation is a Fourier transform on this Lie algebra, and then you reduce everything to the new potent elements in that Lie algebra. And then you realize some product formula, which gives you the whole thing, and then you compute the important parts separately. But the nice thing is that the result only will work out nicely if you put together many of these non-homogeneous varieties. So now I give you the result of this computation, which was basically doing this Fourier transform for these two varieties, and then you get this giant generating function. So you fix the dimensions of the training vector spaces, this additional independent vertex, and you let the original bees to vary. Then for each of them, you compute the cohomology of the pure variety to the fixed W, and then this varying V. You compute its Poincaré polynomial. This is the compactly supported Poincaré polynomial, there is S or Q shift. I don't know which one is it now. Maybe it's actually it's the ordinary one now. Anyway, but this is a good form of the conjecture. So you have this generating function of all the Poincaré polynomials in the curve value. And then here you have this fraction which gives you the result. So this is somehow the result of the new potent things in the denominator and the numerator. Just comes from this in a simple shift with the W's. The denominator does not depend on the W, it only depends on the V's here, the W here is the denominator. It's a big combinatorial formula, but it's a combinatorial formula. So from this on, it's only a matter of computers and stuff to compute this. Because you take these rational functions, I can tell you what things are here, but very simple. And this really, everything emerged from that simple idea to push this Fourier transform argument for this mm-hmm. variety story. I give you some more details about what's what here, but I don't think it's really necessary to understand. What's crucial for the argument, because somehow the middle dimensional cohomology of non-homogeneous variety is the top non-vanishing cohomology, or in the case of the completely supported cohomology, the bottom non-vanishing cohomology. In this case, Q and I equals the dimension, so that is when Q equals zero, this is going to be a generating function of the middle dimensional cohomologies of non-vanishing varieties. So from this big formula, you will get an artificial way to have a formula for the generating function, the middle dimensional cohomology of non-vanishing varieties. And you will see in a moment if you will have additional information about that, because that's where non-homogeneous constructive all the reducible, highest beta, reducible, highest beta representations of the cuts of the algebra attached to the feeder. Okay, so two ingredients we need for the proof of cuts conjecture one. One is, again, a nice combinatorial formula for the characters, if you like, of the highest weight irreducible representations of the Kac-Moody algebra. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. If the killer is finite, this is your usual semi-simple algebra. If it's an affine killer, then it's an affine algebra. For more general killers, they can be really complicated in the algebra. And they are not even easy to define. Anyway, there are some analogs of finite dimensional algebras attached to killers. They have a nice highest state theory of representations, and in particular, there is a generalization of the Weyl character formula, which I'm giving. This is called the Weyl-Kac character formula because it's the generalization of the Weyl character formula in the finite, like the semi-simple algebra case. Okay, so you take any irreducible representation corresponding to the highest state lambda, then you rewrite the representation into its weight spaces like that, okay? And then if you have this, then you can write down this character of its, the dimensions of these weight spaces. So these will be typically infinite dimensional. And so, but then the weight spaces themselves will be finite dimensional. And this character formula gives us a formula of what the dimensions of these weight spaces are. And the formula is some combinatorial expression, but here appears the quantity which we are after. This M alpha, again, this is part of Kac's theory. This is the quantity. It has a separate meaning, which I'm not at the beginning to now, but you can think of this, these are the M alphas we are after, the multiplicities of the roots. They appear in the Laplace denominator, which is typically now going to the infinite products compared to the finite dimensional case. Okay, so this is some formula in representation theory we use, and the other one is a geometrical result of a geometric representation theory result by Nakajima, who constructed these representations on the middle cohomology of Nakajima Kubler varieties. So these highest weights are one-to-one correspondence with these W's. So to a W, we have this highest weight, lambda W, and we are going to construct an irreducible, or not we, Nakajima, constructed an irreducible representations of the Kac-Moody algebra of highest weight lambda W, where you fix W and you let V to anything. You take all these Nakajima varieties, state them, and on this, he constructed the representation explicitly using some convolutional formulas. And now, if you put this together, these two results, then we have this representation. We know it's a character formula, so we have now an independent formula for the middle cohomology. So the middle cohomology, middle Betti numbers of Nakajima Kubler varieties satisfy this combinatorial formula, where now these M alphas we would like to relate to the Kac polynomial here. And this is the way to put things together, because now I can put things together to really give some sketch, maybe the proof of the first Kac conjecture. You can see how all these ideas interact. So the Weyl-Kac Nakajima formula, plus now our main formula, we already have this formula about the genetic function of all Nakajima, in other words, all homologies. Taking Q equals 0 gives us precisely the genetic function for the middle Betti numbers. So that's what this Weyl-Kac Nakajima formula gave us. That if I take this was my formula for the Poincaré polynomial, then Q equals 0, this gives me the genetic function for the middle cohomology by Nakajima. It has a representation, the highest weight representation of the Kac-Moody algebra, so by the Weyl-Kac character formula, that has such a weight decomposition like that. So you get some equality like that. Maybe I'm good now because we will see soon that the A polynomial is hidden, that will be there. Okay, to do that, first thing we want to say is that if I let, here we have a 3W. We really are interested in a fixed figure with a fixed dimension vector, but we have a 3W, and it turns out that if you send somehow W to infinity, and explicitly you can just take one everywhere, every dimension vector for W, and then you just multiply it with M, the same M, and then you let M go to infinity, you can show that the numerators in both expressions will go to somehow infinity, so you will find that the denominators have to agree. And for the denominator here, we will see a very nice connection with the Kotze's A polynomial. So here is Kotze's A polynomial written down in terms of coefficients, these TI alphas. Then now we can conclude that the denominator here should agree with the Q equals zero specialization of this formula, which for us really from nothing appeared in this Fourier transform thing. But it turns out that this is also, this formula in the denominator is the so-called, the left-hand side of the so-called Hua formula. So the Hua formula is basically was done by Kotz and Stanley in the original paper, but they didn't conclude it. They just wanted to see that the A polynomial is a rational function, and they conceived, but Hua completely pushed it to an actual formula, and he found that the A polynomials are somehow encoded here in this. This is the same kind of exp and log bay in this platistic exponential. This is we did for character varieties. Anyway, I just don't want to write that, so I just this simplified formula which remembers all the TI alphas, all these coefficients of the A polynomials can be computed. And again, it is also similar to our kind of left hand side, right? It's just a partition of the dimension vector at every vertex. You have a vector of partitions, and then you have a similar simple formula. Okay, so now you know that this thing agrees with the Q equals zero part of this, but here it's easy to take Q equals zero. It's just singling out the constant terms, and this is going to be the Q equals zero part, because this part has to be zero, I plus J has to be zero. And now the two agrees, and from that you can okay, so anyway, I just wanted to give you, basically my contribution was just to compute the petty numbers of numbers of your varieties, the rest is putting together results from the literature. And then that gave the proof. So, very good. So I have even 10 minutes, but I guess I went faster. I have one more slide to discuss a very nice global version of this Hutz polynomial business, which yielded the first closed formula for the net numbers of mixed multiple spaces. And this is due to Olivier Schiffman, and it was done or published in 2016, maybe, but done probably in 2015. So the idea is, which we should have done reading, or we tried things like that, because I told you that we got to the pure varieties from the character varieties, and we were honestly interested in Higgs bundles anyway. And even for Higgs bundles, you could see connections to pure varieties. But the way how Olivier managed to do things was really, really remarkable. So what he does, he introduces the analog notion of absolutely the composable representation of the Fourier. So the idea is that we replace the Fourier with the curve, and we will think of a representation of the Fourier as a vector bundle over the curve. I mean, there are even categorical analogies. I think most of them are probably one category or something like that. So somehow these are very similar categories. So you can ask the same kind of question over a finite field. So let's assume the curve is defined over a finite field. So you can talk about vector bundles over the curve over the finite field. It makes sense to say absolutely in the composable, which in this algebraic geometry language is just geometrically in the composable, meaning that if you exchange to the algebraic closure, that vector model there becomes in the composable, which just means it's going to be like some two smaller vector models. You fix the rank and the degree, and then you will have half to isomorphism, finite, minimalist. such vector bundles. I am sure it's clear. You can count this, and this is going to be now a function of Q, but dependent on C. Now, the dependence on C will not be just through its genus. The genus is recorded there. Let me show you an example. So, the easiest example is the rank one case, because what do we do? The rank one, there is no, the condition is vacuous. So you really are counting up to isomorphism my models of say degree 0 or any degree, any fixed degree over the curve. So it's like counting points on the Jacobian or the other Jacobian of the curve. And it turns out that it has a very nice formula for the count. And this is the formula. And these alpha i's are the so-called Weyl numbers. Abstractly, you can say these are some of the eigenvalues of Frobenius acting on the first homology of the curve, the attack homology of the curve, or something like that. But they also explicitly show up the famous formula on which Weyl proved, and he based on his Weyl conjectures based on that. If you count the number of FQ or FQ to the endpoints of your curve, and you form the trending function, or this is again not now similar to our kind of statistic, this is some statistic explanation. Then you get the setup, the so-called zeta function of the curve. If the zeta function sees the cohomology of the curve in this very precise way, then you will see the degree 0, degree 2 cohomology, and here on degree 1 cohomology, these alpha i's show up, which are exactly. So these are somehow inscribed in the arithmetic of the curve. You get these Weyl numbers. And so you see, in particular, when the rank is 1, that the result is actually a polynomial with the Weyl numbers. You should know that these Weyl numbers come in pairs, and that product is Q. So Q is there as well, so somehow the Weyl numbers generate Q. So previously we said things are polynomial in Q. Now we will be saying things are polynomial, or we will say things are polynomial in the Weyl numbers. And that's his first result, which is the analog of Kotze's theorem, that it is polynomial in the Weyl numbers of C. Then he goes on, and he manages to find in a complicated way in the first paper, then he has a layer paper with Moscow Heuberg, and managed to simplify the argument to show that the same kind of Crowley-Bowie show business works, and so now Crowley-Bowie won better business works, and you can relate this global version of Eckert's polynomial now with the high regular version of the monomial space of vector models. So his second main result is that the Poincaré polynomial, or any formalism rather, it's the polynomial with the compactly supported cohomology of the Poincaré polynomial, the Higgs monomial space, which you now recall is a semi-projective variety. Therefore, it's really the same as the polynomial. It has this very nice formula. So you take this polynomial in the Weyl numbers, and here is your formula for the Betti numbers of the Higgs-Müller spaces. Okay, this is still not computed, but it's put in the same kind of framework as Kotze's polynomials. And the hardest part of the paper was into actually computing those polynomials. And this is basically finding the analog of Kuas formula, but things are much more complicated because the stack of all representations in that case, the stack of bundles, it's not something is not finite, it is infinite many points, so he has to truncate those stacks, and he really has to invent a lot of logical stuff. He uses whole algebra representations, Eisenstein series, things he had done before, and eventually he manages to get a closed formula, the first closed formula for the Betti numbers of the Higgs-Mulley space. So this formula has an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage is that it's a theorem. The disadvantage is that it's even more complicated than our conjecture. And so at this point, I don't think this theorem, we don't yet know if it agrees with our conjecture. So his is much more complicated. I think it was computed by his tool, where it matched with whatever the conjecture. But it's much harder. There are, besides the same sort of statistical logarithm business, exponential business theories, that's all residue formalism, iterative residues, that's the kind of thing I will talk next time. And actually, it's a very complicated. So it's really a beautiful result. The first closed formula, and I mentioned last time that now there is a claim by Maulik and Pixton, so we might have another closed formula, but that is closer to my heart, because that will be hopefully a quadratic conjecture. Okay, and let me finish with a little discussion on one of the interesting conjectures of Schiffman, and he's conjecturing that this is independent of D. So it's not even the case of course, I should have said, oh, this is only in the case, just like, so the D and N being co-primes analogs to this indivisible, and divisible is this in the clear writing case. But here he's claiming or conjecturing, which works for the small cases he could compute, that the result is independent of D. So even if D is not co-prime to R, this sound should be the same independent of D. It's really remarkable. And this, of course, all comes back to this original observation, which was made in this one by Daniel Alcock, that the Betti numbers of the character lines should be independent of D, because it's a much stronger version of that. Of course, if this is independent of D, then the Poincaré polynomial will be independent, but these are somehow almost the whole motif, you know, so it's the count of any finite field of the curve. Yes, and I now maybe I can mention, hopefully, the recent result by two of my students, Michael Dershin and the next student, they did this, my present student at Paul Ziegler. They did a periodic integration along the fibers of the Lichen map, and they proved a topological neurosynaptic conjecture. And I hope they as well believe that it will actually prove this statement, at least compared to, I mean, there is a statement about that statement will follow the independence of the from there. So we will see. But again, this situation is the top.
Questions?
Yeah. So you described all various different themes for computing these numbers, some conjectural and some not. If I wanted actually know the numbers, like I want a computer program to do it, which scheme is the fastest?
Well, I don't think this one was. I mean, that's one thing about these formulas. More formula is in the computer. So.
And how high can you go with that formula?
Well, if you just want these basic ones, then you only have G, R, and R by G. I think we went up to. We had this paper where we looked at very big examples. So we did compute very big. I think we fixed G to be 2, and I'm sure we went up to R is 10. And it's really now, I mean, this exponential business is not trivial, but if it's programmed cleverly, and it was not time, so it was programmed cleverly, but I said it was going, then you have an efficient way to. But as I told you, the other amazing aspect of that we did not know that the result was a polynomial in the formalism. We now know this by Anton Bennett's proof from last year. And hopefully, by this result I have mentioned, we will know that this is the correct result. But we have formulas for 10 characterized or Higgs bundles, and that's all one. So we
questions?
So, when you made your extended thing, what if you just went one step and you just have another minus one? That would be relatively prime when you do something small.
No, that's true, but. My hunch is that I need for the whole the whole my loop here. So I need Sn minus 1 equals Sn. In that way, you won't only have Sn 2. Actually, I don't think that we know about the original figure. But I might be. I'm sure that there might be able to know the same thing.
Okay, well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Thomas again.